From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, two stories about mysterious things in the woods. Maple and mushrooms. Our first story comes from producer Barbara Paulson and takes us into the wild world of mushroom hunters. Here's Barbara.
This story starts with this woman named Donna.
Hello, my name is Donna Camille Davis.
So on a November day a few years back, Donna and her boyfriend got in their car and they drove north from their home in San Francisco.
So if you can imagine, on the coast of Northern California, you've got some fog, things are dewy, everything smells like the earth. Feels like you're going to run into some elves and fairies up there.
This is not a real place. This is a made-up place.
I know, right? It is pretty magical.
We were finding the most amazing mushrooms. There, I think we counted 7 different types of varieties of edible mushrooms, from hedgehogs, chanterelles, trumpets, black trumpets, bluettes, matsutakis, no porcinis because it wasn't the time of year, but...
Okay, so Sam, do you know the difference between those mushrooms and the ones you find in your grocery store?
I have eaten a couple wild mushrooms. I think I could pick like a black trumpet and a chanterelle, but that's about it.
Well, then you're in better shape than I was at the beginning of the story. But one of the things that I found is that these wild mushrooms, unlike, say, you know, your standard button or portobellos that you find in most grocery stores, we haven't figured out how to farm them.
Oh, okay.
So if you want to eat these wild mushrooms, and lots of people do because they've got way more interesting flavors than commercial mushrooms.
Well, I guess you've got to go out into the forest and find them for yourself.
Exactly.
Not everybody can do this, so there's a special quality to it.
What do you mean not everybody can do it?
Well, not everybody would do it. Let me put it that way. Not everybody has the confidence to go out there and forage for mushrooms, know what they're looking for. It's just a different breed of person, let me put it that way, that would go and do that, okay?
It's like, you know, there's the breed of person who's not afraid of dying and the people who, you know, who maybe are.
But, you know, in this case, Donna really did know what she was doing because she'd been mushroom hunting for years. I mean, she'd found porcinis the size of her head.
Oh, my gosh.
But as it turns out, on that day in November, well, she kind of made a mistake.
And on the way home, it was, oh, man, I cannot keep my head up. This is crazy. I must be coming down with something.
She was just, you know, exhausted. She slept for 3 whole days. And then after all these days in bed, she got up, looked at herself in the mirror.
And I saw that I was jaundiced. I was yellow.
Well, so when they told you, we think this is mushroom poisoning, what went through your head?
This is going to be interesting. This is going to be interesting.
If you make a decision to eat mushrooms you find in the wild, you are taking a risk because poisonous mushrooms kill people every year.
Which is why I'm going to try and answer the question, what is it exactly about mushroom hunting that makes people risk their lives to do it? To understand mushroom hunters, you've got to go hunt mushrooms. So, last spring, I went to the very place where Donna Davis got herself into trouble, Salt Point State Park in California's Sonoma Valley. I drive there with this guy named Patrick Hamilton.
So, if you knew me better at all, you'd really realize I have had a very colorful life.
Patrick's a self-taught mushroom expert, and he's been at it for decades. He's got a ponytail and a soul patch, and he became fascinated with mushrooms back in the 80s. After smoking some really strong weed.
I know more than they do. That's not a wild mushroom. I'm groovy.
These days, he teaches groups of beginners how to identify edible mushrooms.
These are things that took me years to learn. I mean years.
There's a steady drizzle as about a dozen of us gather in the parking lot. And before Patrick teaches us what we should be looking for, he sends us off to pick any mushrooms we can find.
Okay, just go look, see, do whatever. You see something, find, bring it, okay? Mushrooms grow on the ground, they grow on trees.
Did you guys find something?
Yeah.
Can I come talk to you about it?
Did you get it?
That's so cool.
I found a slimy mushroom.
This thing is really gross. We think that it might be poisonous, whatever it is.
This, I pulled off a bit of tree.
What's that?
And I don't know what it is.
Elijah, give me some of that weird stuff.
some of that weird stuff. I like really? The technical term.
These are really slimy.
After 15 minutes, we meet up to show what we've picked. And Patrick, he has us lay all the mushrooms out on a log. Most of them, he says, are inedible, especially this one that's poisonous.
Yeah. Don't ever, ever eat a mushroom that looks like this growing out of wood. This is called a deadly gallerina.
He tells us how to identify the three or four mushrooms we want to find today. Black trumpets, hedgehogs, candy caps, and chanterelles.
When you find these, there's always more. There's rarely just one. And now that you know what they look like, nothing else looks like this, okay? So I don't need to see the
And then he sends us off again. Only this time, we know what we're looking for. Only it's really hard. And I'm not the only one who can't find anything.
But yeah, so how are we getting? How are we not getting our eye in? What are we doing?
Why are they finding mushrooms and you're not?
Patrick isn't having it. He knows that our eyes just haven't adjusted yet. We're looking, but our eyes don't know what to look for.
So get on your hands and knees, for Christ's sake, and look up underneath them there, you guys.
He points to some black trumpets that are right there, hidden under leaves.
I saw that one right there.
Oh, wow.
And then that one. And then that one. They're that hard to see.
Oh, my gosh.
It doesn't mean you're a failure.
And it's weird because once Patrick points them out, it gets easier to spot them. It's like one of those magic eye books from the 90s. You know, the ones with the meaningless patterns that hide a 3D image? You stare and stare and stare, and then all of a sudden, pop, there's a picture.
Oh, look at this one. Wait, is that one? Or is it a...
Yeah, that's a yellow one. Wow.
Here, and here's a candy cap.
So excited.
And right then is when Patrick says it's time for us to head back.
Let's go!
Just when we hit the mother load.
I'm drenched by the rain, my pants are smeared with mud, but I'm crazed about doing this now. I just want more. As it turns out, there's a term for what happened to me in the woods in California. Scientists call it the pop-out effect. At first, you can't find mushrooms at all, because they blend into the earth and leaves so perfectly. But then...
all of a sudden, you see something peeking out from underneath the dead leaves, and you're like, oh my God, is that what I think it is? And then you see one. And then it's on. Game's on. You're like, oh my God, there's another one. There's another one.
Mushroom hunters like Donna call this getting your eyes on.
It's like that moment of going from not seeing to seeing. Holy moly, that's magical.
I used to work for National Geographic, so for years I sent reporters all over the world to hang out with hunter-gatherer tribes. And when they got back, you know, their feet would be cut up and they'd be covered with insect bites, but they'd all tell me the same thing. Even though it's really hard living off the land, there is something deeply satisfying about finding your own food. And that just makes sense. I mean, our eyes are built to do this, to scour the ground for food. And every time we find something tasty, our brains give us this little chemical jolt. It's what foragers call mushroom fever.
You get greedy, honestly. You get greedy. You find one, you're like, oh my God, I gotta find some more. And I want more, and I want more. It can be an obsession.
And that's exactly what happened on that day in November 2014 when Donna and her boyfriend went mushroom hunting. They stuffed bags full of mushrooms, and they brought them back home to sort through.
We didn't see anything unusual. There were some pieces there that didn't have the caps on it, so we tossed them out just to be safe. And felt we, you know, had gone through them all and checked them and thought, okay, everything's good.
The next day, Donna got ready to cook the mushrooms.
Clean them, get all the dirt out of them.
And she invited friends over for mushroom soup.
The sautéed onions that were very, very soft and browned, and the chanterelles that had been cooked nicely. I think I'm going to put a little pinch of salt and garlic in it, and then a little bit of the half and half. And I took that and I blended it, so it was a puree flavor that just poured out of it.
The soup was delicious.
It was so good, I had a second bowl.
Three days later, Donna dragged herself out of bed, and when she looked in the mirror...
I saw that I was jaundiced. I was yellow, and I thought, okay.
She rushed to the hospital.
They took one look at me, and they wheeled me right upstairs.
And the doctors asked her,
What did you do? They wanted to know what was going on.
Donna told them she'd gone foraging and eaten some wild mushrooms, and the hospital had had an earlier patient who got poisoned and died.
So they immediately started the procedure for extracting poison from my body.
And so did you ever think about the mushrooms before they mentioned it?
No, not at all. Wasn't even on my mind.
There's a good reason Donna didn't realize she'd been poisoned, because it took a while for her symptoms to appear. That delay was actually a clue. It suggested that Donna had probably eaten a mushroom called Amanita phalloides, or the death cap. Other mushrooms can poison you, make you so sick you might wish you were dead, but it's the death cap that's most likely to kill you, because its toxins work slowly. By the time you begin to feel really sick, it's got a head start on digesting your liver from the inside out.
There are people that accidentally poison themselves with death caps just about every year. It happens.
That's Kat Adams. She studies mycology at the University of California at Berkeley. She says the death cap is responsible for 90% of fatal mushroom poisonings worldwide. But despite its deadly reputation, Kat is enchanted by it.
I think it's a really beautiful mushroom. It starts as a cute little button.
And it grows up to be an elegant, mostly white mushroom that has gills underneath and a greenish tinge to its cap. But it's actually not even supposed to be in North America.
The death cap was never here before about 1930.
That's when American botanists imported certain oak trees from Europe. And it turned out that the native soil around the tree's roots was lousy with death cap spores. This deadly mushroom's been spreading across North America ever since. It's been spotted in forests from Maryland, north into New Hampshire and Maine, and on the West Coast from LA all the way up to British Columbia. But it's especially plentiful in Northern California. And with so many amateurs now cooking up wild mushrooms in their risotto, the number of poisonings is going up.
Because it's so common, it smells good, it tastes good, apparently. I've read a lot of reports of people that have been poisoned, and unanimously people report that it was a very delicious mushroom, even as they're dying.
Last winter, 14 people were poisoned in Northern California in the month of December alone. Four were trying to get high on magic mushrooms. But most of the victims were just cooking up mushrooms for dinner. One meal poisoned five people, including an 18-month-old girl. She now has permanent brain damage. In every case, a death cap was somehow mistaken for an edible mushroom.
There's a couple different reasons I think people might get it mixed up. Some of that is that it can grow intermixed with other actual edibles. And so if you're not paying really close attention as you harvest things, you might accidentally slip one in your basket. And if that's the case, like, one is enough to kill you, right? And so the deadliness of it makes minor mistakes much more dangerous.
The whole episode of being in the hospital is another, like, Alice in Wonderland story in and of itself.
Once doctors realized Donna had likely been poisoned by a death cap, they asked her more questions.
Like, do you have a will? You need one now. Do you understand what it's like to have a liver transplant?
Donna was in bad shape. She was throwing up the charcoal doctors had given her to extract the poison. Enzyme levels showed her liver was failing. And then Donna started to hallucinate.
For some reason, I'm seeing this path. It's like I could look down the ground. There's like pebbles, clear pebbles, crisp, and a canopy of trees. And I could see the leaves and the veins and the bark. And as I walked down the path, it was completely pitch black. And I thought, okay, I'm not going there. I get this. I'm not gonna die, you know.
Because of how badly she was doing, her doctor told her she was at the top of the liver transplant list, which has more than 14,000 people waiting on it. But when a liver became available, She said no.
And they were just like, this lady is crazy, she must be high.
But Donna was right. Though her enzyme levels stayed dangerously high for several days, on her fifth day in ICU, her levels came way down. Her liver started to regenerate.
And so is your liver damaged as a result, partially, or is there lingering damage?
No, it's a full recovery. It's kind of unbelievable, you know, it's rare.
This past summer, citing the rise of mushroom poisonings, the CDC issued a warning. They called the spread of death cap mushrooms a serious public health concern, and they issued a caution against eating foraged mushrooms.
It's that mushrooms have a notoriety, right?
I called up Patrick Hamilton, the guy who took me mushroom hunting. He wasn't impressed.
It looks like, wild mushroom poisoning! I think people fall off ladders a lot more, right? That's a much greater public health concern.
That analogy isn't really fair. I mean, a lot more people climb ladders every day than go foraging for mushrooms. But Patrick's right that there are very few mushroom-related deaths, only 10 or so annually. If you're a mushroom hunter, this all fits into a maddening pattern. Even though very few wild mushrooms are poisonous, most Americans are afraid of them because they don't know which ones are safe to eat. That's called mycophobia. But then when they do learn about mushroom foraging and try it out, a few get themselves poisoned. That triggers tons of sensational press, warnings from the CDC, and that just feeds Americans' fear of mushrooms. It's a bit of a vicious circle. So when people get poisoned by mushrooms, there's often this backlash against the victims by the mushroom hunting community.
So when you see mushroom poisonings reported in the press, what goes through your mind?
People doing stupid things. Really? I mean, it's like, why would you put something in your mouth and eat it that you don't know what it is? In that moment, they're stupid.
Patrick uses that word
stupid
over and over to explain why people eat poisonous mushrooms.
I don't know how else to explain it, Barbara. I mean, people think stupid. Stupider, stupidest.
So, no surprise, when Donna Davis's poisoning became public, the mushroom community was not exactly sympathetic. They seized on a detail from a news report that said Donna had confused a hedgehog mushroom, which has these pretty distinctive toothy spikes under its head, with a death cap mushroom, which has gills underneath.
A hedgehog looks no more like a death cap than you look like me. I know the story. It was the most poo-pooed story by mushroom people around. I mean, we more than rolled our eyes. Said, oh, yes, it's really easy to mistake mushrooms. No, it's not. A death cap looks like a death cap.
The backlash to Donna's story on the internet was just as dismissive. Mushroom hunters were like, she hasn't bothered to learn to identify the number one deadly mushroom. If you know what you're doing, you could never make that mistake. Patrick cites this old adage.
There are old mushroom hunters and there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old, bold mushroom hunters.
In other words, experienced mushroom hunters don't accidentally eat deadly mushrooms.
But I disagree with that.
That's Kat Adams again, the death cap expert.
I've read like every paper there is about the death cap.
Kat's done a review of the literature on death cap poisoning, and she says even super experienced mushroom hunters can make mistakes.
There are instances of people having collected mushrooms from the forest for years and years and years, and in their later years accidentally getting poisoned and dying. I think sometimes a lot of people that do mushroom hunting are scornful towards those that get poisoned as a way to sort of make themselves feel better. But I think that really this could happen to anyone. Really, we should see them as examples of the fact that what we do is inherently a little dangerous and that we have to stay vigilant always. And so I think that people should have compassion for someone that makes that mistake.
I asked Donna where she thinks she went wrong that day she got poisoned, and she told me it's hard to say, but she figures she must have accidentally slipped a death cap into her bag of hedgehog mushrooms. And while it's remarkable that she survived, it's maybe more remarkable that even though her boyfriend and several friends also ate the mushroom soup that night, she was the only one who got sick. That's because she actually made two batches of soup, one with chanterelles, the other with only hedgehogs.
Lo and behold, I was the one who ate the soup that had the poisonous mushroom. Thank God, I kept on thinking, thank God they didn't have the same soup I had. Thank God.
Did you ever just like feel like, oh my God, how could I have been so stupid?
No, I didn't. I never felt that way. It was just something that happened.
Since her recovery, Donna's made changes in her life. She slowed things down. She says her real mistake was that she got overconfident, and that may have made her careless.
So in hindsight, okay, what I would have done differently is if we had seen, you know, some of the stems without the caps, would have thrown the whole batch out.
So you still forage mushrooms?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah, I do.
But I have to say that, like, kind of surprises me that you would continue to do it after this.
You know, you make your decisions, you know, how you want to live your life. Do you want to live your life in fear? And, you know, a lot of people would say, I'll never eat mushrooms again, or I'll never do that again. And I choose not to live my life that way.
Oh, gosh. Would you, Barbara, do you think you would eat a wild mushroom again after something like that?
I did eat some of the ones that I foraged, but in that case, you know, a very experienced mushroom hunter had looked them over and said that they were fine. But I actually think that once you learn how to distinguish some that are quite easy to identify, you'd be surprised. You gain the confidence that, yeah, I would. I would do that.
But have you yet?
Yes. Oh, on my own?
On your own?
No.
No.
No, I haven't. Not yet.
If you want to eat the delicious and dangerous wild mushrooms, please, please, please consult professionals. After the break, we're going back into the woods to find out what the heck is going on with maple syrup. Stay with us. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Our next story starts with a mystery in a small town in Vermont, way up near the Canadian border, called Island Pond. Like a lot of small, rural, northern New England towns, things are rough there economically. Income is around half the average for the rest of the state, and for years, wages have been falling and people were moving away. But then, a few years back, people started to hear about something through the grapevine.
Yeah, right. You hear things, right?
Up in that part of the world, Sweet Tree was kind of a big deal.
Sweet Tree. That's the name of the company that got this community buzzing. There are two people talking here, but we've disguised their voices. I couldn't get anyone to tell me this story unless the interview was anonymous. At first, this was confusing because no one was saying anything particularly controversial. I have some theories about this, but we'll come back to them later. They were invited as part of a private tour of Sweet Tree's new facility.
And so you drive into this small Vermont Northeast Kingdom town, and then you come upon what was formerly a Ethan Allen furniture manufacturing facility. So it looks like a warehouse. It's like gray, corrugated metal siding.
So the facility had very shiny, gleaming new stuff, and it just felt very strange. Like we're walking into some creepy lab where you don't know what they're doing.
I don't think that the region had seen anything like this kind of investment going into such a state-of-the-art, massive facility.
So what are they building? This, quote, creepy lab, unquote, was not growing organs or designing weapons for the Department of Defense. Sweet Tree was building a massive maple sugaring operation. Eventually, it would drill holes into as many as 1 million sugar maples and extract sap from those trees with more than 6,000 miles of tubing, enough to stretch all the way across the country. The owner, who it turns out was actually a Massachusetts-based life insurance company, is planning to sink tens of millions of dollars into the facility. When it's finished, it would be 8 times bigger than the previous largest maple sugaring operation in the United States. This was a facility that looked in every way like a maple syrup factory. Yes, industrial in scale, but still understandable. Taps in maple trees, evaporators for boiling the sap, maple syrup, which is where we get to the weirdest part of this tour.
So did anybody at any point ask, are you guys making maple syrup?
We asked whether they were making maple syrup, and they said no. We're making other products. And that was it.
They wouldn't reveal what product they were going to go into. Obviously, this is not going to be... I mean, they were very clear that it was not going to be maple syrup sold in bottles.
The pervasive feeling that I got from that whole visit was, what's going on here? And what the heck are they doing with that sap if they're not making maple syrup?
Mysteries are brewing in the sugar shack. Changes are coming to New England's sugar bushes. And the very identity of a product that we've been crafting in basically the same way for centuries could be on the verge of a radical shift. But a shift towards what? Allow me to present for debate, from my very New England-centric perch up here in New Hampshire, the following statement. Maple syrup is the quintessential North American agricultural product. Discuss. I'd like to acknowledge here that there's a big chunk of our listeners who are not as intimately aware of where maple syrup comes from as we New Englanders are, so while you formulate your response to my debate prompt, as a starting point, I think you need to understand the nostalgic picture of maple syrup that people like me have.
This one tree here has three trunks, so there's a bucket on each trunk.
The process of making maple syrup is slow.
To get musical ones.
Holes drilled into trees, slowly, drip by drip, fill buckets. Those buckets, gathered by hand, are poured together and boiled for hours or days until it becomes syrup. This is the romantic picture of maple syrup production that many New Englanders still have. A pure product, straight from a tree, straight out of a mature, living forest.
So the sap needs cool nights and warm days for it to...
This is the home of Nancy Ritger, who lives in Hart's Location, New Hampshire, a town with a population of a couple dozen people. She and her husband, Mark, hang around 60 buckets on maple trees in and around their property.
All right, that one's full.
With just a couple of differences, this is what maple sugaring has looked like for hundreds, even thousands of years. Drip by drip by drip, log after log on the fire. It is the opposite of efficient. It's about as simple a processed food as you can imagine. Native Americans used to slash maple trees with axes and gather sap in birch baskets. They would plop hot rocks inside to boil off the water, leaving behind the concentrated sugar. Nancy and Mark are only slightly higher tech than this. They drag the sap to the backyard on a sled. They boil it over an open fire in a big stock pot.
Because we're boiling down approximately 40 gallons of sap to 1 gallon of syrup, depending on how diligent we are, it could take a day or two or 3 days. You know, we don't always start it and finish it all at once. But we'll oftentimes come out here late in the day, build a fire, tend it until somebody's, you know, got dinner made, and then go inside, have dinner, come back out, stoke up the fire, and let it go until the morning.
And for a very long time, all of the nation's syrup was coming from operations like Nancy's. And this is one of the craziest facts that I learned while reporting this story. Peak production of maple for the United States was in 1860. When opposition to cane sugar, made by exploiting the labor of enslaved people, drove many northerners to seek a native sweetener. We're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 6.4 million gallons, compared to 4.2 million last year. Since most of New England's forests were gone, probably every accessible maple tree would have had to have been tapped, and the labor involved would have been simply staggering.
So if you had to estimate the man hours that you put into this every season, what
would
you
say? We probably would stop doing it.
It's a hobby, remember?
But for most of the maple syrup on your table, this is not what it looks like anymore.
Yeah, it's not quite put together at the moment, but...
So those need to be connected.
Yeah, these need to be connected.
This is me touring the University of Vermont's Maple Lab. Abby Vandenberg, head of the lab, is leading me on the tour, and I hope it doesn't weird her out to hear me say this, but I think she's probably the smartest person I've ever interviewed. In front of us are two identical, very large, very shiny stainless steel evaporators. They're identical so that they can be used for maple syrup experiments.
So, for example, an aliquot of sap, you know, raw sap that has been concentrated to whatever percentage with reverse osmosis, and then the raw sap that was used to generate that concentrate processed simultaneously.
Did you say an aliquot?
I did.
What is that?
A portion.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm in my science mode. Yeah, I'm gonna throw it out there.
I like learning words, so this is great. But.
These days, the whole process, the buckets, the carrying the sap back, the boiling, looks totally different. For starters, most of the work of concentrating sap into syrup is now done using reverse osmosis. This is a machine that pushes the sap through a membrane with very tiny, tiny holes that only let water through, leaving sap with more concentrated sugar left on the other side. Starting the boil with more concentrated sap saves sugar producers a ton of work and about two-thirds of their fuel costs, and lots of maple makers have switched to using it. Abby and her team study whether that had an impact on the syrup's taste.
We do extensive chemical analyses. We also do sensory evaluations to see, can panelists taste an overall difference in the syrup produced with those two technologies?
So taste test.
Sensory evaluation test. Yes. Sensory experiments, taste evaluations.
Seriously, huge brain, smarter than all of those particle physicists. And the answer to that question, by the way, is no, using reverse osmosis did not change the taste of syrup.
So it's really pretty remarkable.
Not only is the boiling of the sap now just the finishing step of making syrup, it's often done burning propane or oil instead of wood. And the iconic maple syrup buckets, gone.
That is probably the other major feature of modern maple production is collecting sap in a network of tubing.
Now, most sugar bushes, which is what you call a forest full of maple trees, are spider webs of blue and green plastic.
You can, in addition to just collecting it based on gravity-induced flow, you can augment that with adding vacuum to the system. So
vacuum, like sucking the sap up through the roots of the tree.
Adding a vacuum pump to the end doesn't suck sap out, but it increases the pressure differential between the inside of the tree and the outside of the tree.
Okay, so not like sucking the sap out of the tree, creating a steep pressure gradient the way your mouth does at the end of a straw when you're sucking.
Practically speaking, the ultimate result of this is that by using vacuum systems, we've been able to basically double the amount of sap yield that we get from an individual tree.
Reverse osmosis, plastic tubing, vacuum pumps, all of these innovations have been around for decades, but their adoption really only started to get serious after the year 2000. Since 2001, maple syrup yield has almost doubled. That product that seemed impossible to make efficiently, we are starting to make it efficiently, by God. We are making more gallons of syrup per tap than ever before. Which leads us to some maple anxiety that you might have caught on to.
Next up, climate change may be hitting the maple syrup industry's sweet spot.
A new study has found that the trees that make maple syrup will struggle to survive climate change.
The best conditions? Cool nights just below freezing and warm days in the upper 40s.
So, is maple syrup doomed by climate change?
No.
At least not soon. Eventually, it might get too hot for maples to grow in some places. But for now, Abby says, out of a 6-week-long sugaring season, over the last 50 years, we've lost, on average, about 3 days, or 7%, due to climate change.
You know, the yields per tap have actually been increasing that entire time. So at least currently, technology is really just swamping out any of the effects that the industry is experiencing from climate change.
So, gut check here. How do you feel about this?
buckets in the woods replaced with a network of tubes, wood fires replaced with oil, sap vacuumed up through the trees. Are we still feeling okay about this product? It's more efficient, right? Which ostensibly means it's cheaper, more accessible than it would be otherwise. So maybe we're cool with leaving our nostalgic picture behind.
This is called a screw pump from Atlas Copco. This is the most advanced, best vacuum pump in the industry right here.
Well, let's keep pulling this thread.
So what's crazy here to me, like if you're used to backyard sugaring in the bucket where it's just like drip, 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 this is like already a torrent.
Yeah, and it's the same drip, drip, drip out of the tree. It's just this system has 8,000 of those drips coming to it, which is why you see so much at once.
This is Mike Farrell, a former academic who recently moved into the private industry. He's working for a new company called The Forest Farmers, and they've invested in all the stuff, the best vacuum pumps.
How much does something like that cost?
This is $25,000.
Sensors and smartphone apps to monitor his vacuum-sealed tap lines and sap tanks.
So I got an alert this morning. Concentrate upstairs is 91% full, so I know, hey, idiot, don't overflow the concentrate tank.
They've got the giant app-controlled reverse osmosis machine, and of course the pièce de résistance, the huge stainless steel evaporator with more gauges than a submarine that one person can operate and make 600 gallons of syrup an hour.
We're trying to make it as automated and efficient as possible because where I want the labor, where I want my employees out in the woods, that's where you make your money at Sugar, is in the woods getting more sap out of the trees.
The money to pay for all these shiny sap tanks and miles of tubing is coming from two partners, one of whom is a senior advisor at Bain Capital, the firm where Mitt Romney used to work. Mike's operation is only about a quarter of the size of the mystery factory back at the beginning of the episode. But clearly, these are not the same kind of sugaring operations that have been supplying us with syrup for the last 100 years, which were often dairy farmers looking for something to do to make money during the mud season. So what attracted Wall Street to northern Vermont's forests?
If the Quebec producers hadn't invested in that, I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you about this.
To answer that question, we're headed north of the border. But first, a quick break. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. So Mike Farrell, who makes maple syrup for a living, didn't even taste the stuff until he was in grad school.
I mean, we didn't have the money for real maple syrup.
The first time he did try it was at a maple orchard owned by his college when he was a student.
And I was just blown away. I mean, it was delicious and incredible. The whole process, you know, we got to see how the sap's coming out of the trees. And so I wanted to try it. So I didn't do nearly enough research on how I should have done it. And I did some things that I couldn't believe I would do, you know.
Cue the hilarious first try at making maple syrup story.
You know, I originally tried to boil it on the stove and stuff is boiling over and I burned two of my mom's best pots and she said I couldn't do it anymore. So then I had to do it outside. We had a campfire pit with a grate. So all the newspaper that I started to start fire goes up in the air and then lands in my pot of sap. So anyway, so none of the stuff that we tried to make was any good.
But Mike was in love. He wound up applying for a job, running Cornell's research forest, getting it despite being way underqualified, spending too much money for a piece of property right next door to work, and building his own house there. He had it made.
My position there was endowed, so I was guaranteed a salary for life, and I would walk to work. So, really hard thing to give up, right?
It does seem like that would be a really hard thing to give up. So why would you? Well, you have to strike when the iron is hot, as they say.
Yes, my name is Simon Trepanier. I'm the executive director of Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers.
Quebec produces most of the world's maple syrup.
And maple production swings big time year to year based on the weather.
Price of maple syrup was very unstable. When Mother Nature was very generous, suddenly there was a lot of syrup available in the market, and the price was like sky-dropping. It was amazing. From $3 a pound, sometimes it was like under $1 per pound.
Imagine losing two-thirds of your salary from one year to the next. Bank loans for new equipment would dry up, people were selling their land or going bankrupt, and this is when the Maple Federation stepped in.
So there was that big referendum in 1989 where 84% of the producers in Quebec province, they said, yes, we want to work together to negotiate price, to stabilize the price, and to build afterwards a strategic reserve.
They put a cap on how many trees their members can tap and came together to negotiate a single province-wide price on maple syrup. All bulk syrup sold in the province had to go through the system, and any syrup left over would be put into a strategic reserve. You might have heard of this reserve because back in 2012, a couple of black marketeers stole more than 500,000 gallons of it.
Well, Canada seems to have a bit of a sticky problem when it comes to maple syrup. Apparently, lots of it.
Millions of dollars worth of maple syrup has been siphoned off from storage in Quebec, with the crime covered up to avoid detection.
The crime was actually discovered somewhat accidentally. An auditor doing a routine count climbed the mountain of barrels and nearly fell when he gripped onto one that was empty.
Sensational, right? But what you don't hear in those news clips is the way that effectively the Maple Federation's policies have been taking money out of your pocket. Now, the Federation describes itself as a union.
It is totally a union of enterprises, yes.
But it has also been described as a cartel, an organization that coordinates to prop up prices. Because in Quebec, legally, participation in this Federation system is not optional. Any syrup that you can't sell straight to consumers from your farm is subject to their controls and quotas. And Economics 101 says that when you restrict supply, you increase price. By the way, this is a point that the Federation actively disputes.
The quota system does not apply on production itself, and this is maybe misunderstood by a lot of people around. Yeah. We are the quota is on the number of taps you are allowed in your sugar bush in Quebec province.
Which then determines your production.
No, because depending of Mother Nature, depending of your efficiency as a producer, you can produce, as an example, 1 pound per tap, up to 6 pounds per tap.
Okay, so they restrict taps. And yes, weather does have a lot to do with production from year to year, but if there were more taps, invariably we'd have more supply and probably lower prices. And when prices are higher, it's the consumers who pay. You might feel fine about this. That higher price supports a whole maple sugar industry that you might harbor warm and nostalgic feels for. But the bottom line is that because Quebec produces most of the world's syrup, they exert a lot of control over the global price. The Federation also spends a ton of money to increase demand, too. They have a whole marketing campaign, much of it aimed at Asia and Europe, that promotes maple syrup the same way that the Got Milk campaign promotes milk. This has helped to push demand up by 6 or 8% a year. But in a certain way, Quebec's cartel is actually shooting itself in the foot with these efforts, too.
Because they were restricting their own output through a quota system, yet we're able to do whatever we want here or in other provinces. If I want to put in 20,000 taps, I can. You can't do that in Quebec. They can't add taps unless they have quota to be able to do it.
In the mid-2000s, Quebec was producing 80% of the world's maple syrup. To put that in perspective, at the height of its power, OPEC, the dreaded oil cartel, produced 55% of the world's oil. So once they stabilized those high prices, the Quebec maple producers probably felt pretty untouchable. But Quebec isn't the only place in the world with maple trees. And so when they looked behind them, they realized there were some pesky Americans riding their coattails.
And so you can imagine the frustration that they're putting money into a system to help promote maple and help expand the industry, and the industry's expanding, but they're just losing market share.
Since the mid-2000s, Quebec's share of the maple market has dropped to just over 70%.
And so when you say they're losing market share, it's like everyone here was expanding, but they were saying the same size. So all of the excess demand that they were creating with their marketing was going to you guys, kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. Yep. And they were paying for it.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. If the Quebec producers hadn't invested in that, I don't think, probably I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you about this, because I don't think the maple industry would have been growing at such a clip, and my partners probably wouldn't really have had much interest in it.
Quebec province always been like the locomotive of the industry, and there's now new wagons behind that locomotive, because everybody wants to join the train, basically.
And so this is what was going on in Island Pond, the massive factory at the start of the episode, the one people didn't want to talk to me about.
So the facility had very shiny, gleaming new stuff, and it just felt very strange, like we're walking into some creepy lab where you don't know what they're doing.
I think the people who know about Sweet Tree are hesitant to talk about it because they recognize that there's something different here, something that the public might not like about the scale of this operation. And if you're a supporter of the forest industry, or if you're rooting for a struggling town like Island Pond, you probably don't want to come off like you're saying something bad about this operation, even though something about it makes you feel a little weird. I called and emailed Sweet Tree a half dozen times since I started reporting the story, but I couldn't get any sort of comment. They've given a handful of interviews since opening, but they've never said where they're selling their syrup. I can't tell you for sure, but I have theories. Have you heard of maple water? It's basically straight sap, sold at yoga studios and health food stores. Mike Farrell says it's one of the markets he's focused on, and it's my guess that Sweet Tree is angling for something like that, too. Not straight syrup, but new products, new markets, maybe new countries even. This is the reason that the investment wing of a Massachusetts life insurance company could be convinced to pour scads of money into tapping a million maple trees. Why someone who works for Bain Capital would decide to invest his money in hiring Mike Farrell to tap hundreds of thousands of trees in Vermont and a similar sister shop in New York State. It's the case of people who understand economics recognizing the opportunity to be a free rider, a suckerfish attached to the side of the massive shark that is the Quebec maple industry.
Money flows where there's opportunity, and one of the best opportunities in natural resources and agriculture right now is maple.
And so now for a quick note of skepticism on this whole scene, David Marvin of Butternut Mountain. Dave and his family company are a packing house. They buy, bottle, and resell over 60% of Vermont's maple syrup.
The money that's being paid, most of us think, is well above what one would rationally pay for a maple company. But
so are you saying this is a maple bubble?
No. Because somebody would construe that to think that things aren't good in the maple business. Are people maybe paying too much for maple companies? In my humble opinion, they might be, but I think a lot of people who are much more connected to markets than I am would say there's also an awful lot of money looking for a home, and some of that is not necessarily being deployed rationally.
Since Sweet Tree and Mike Farrell both started up, there have been a couple of really good years for maple production. Even with the Quebec quota system, all of this excess supply can't help but push prices down. Mike told me he's not sure he would have spent as much as he has, given the current low prices. In other words, this could have been Alan Greenspan-style irrational exuberance. But regardless, it is supercharging a trend that was already underway. Making maple more capital-intensive. Making it more big business. This isn't your grandfather's maple orchard anymore. It's Bain Capital's. But again, gut check here.
capital coming in means more scale, more efficiency, lower prices, maybe even higher pay for workers. But are you starting to lose some of that nostalgic sheen for the maple industry? Well, how far can we take this? Harvesting maple syrup is a form of agriculture. A forest full of maple doesn't necessarily just spring into existence all on its own. Maple producers cut out trees they don't want and try to encourage more maple trees to grow. This is just something called extensive agriculture. Instead of a monoculture, where there's just one thing that's planted as densely as possible to maximize the efficiency of planting and harvesting, sugar maples are part of a forest. Yes, the forest owner cuts out all of the spruce and the hemlock, but there's still a whole understory that gets to grow alongside the maples, and it's relatively diverse. But letting lots of messy nature into your agricultural operation complicates things too. Squirrels chew on the tubing, moose stumble their way through the sugar bush, tearing out your taps. This is just the cost of doing business. But does it have to be?
This is one of those kind of crazy things that happens from time to time, where you make an observation, you're doing work on something completely different, and have this sort of aha moment that leads you somewhere else.
This is Abby Vandenberg again, University of Vermont maple scientist, giant brain, you remember. Abby made a discovery back in 2014 that kind of made some people freak out. She and a colleague were trying to see how sap was moving through specific parts of maple trees. So they chopped a bunch of maple saplings off at about waist height and strapped a vacuum tube to the top of the stump. When you look at the photos of this, it's almost like a tiny maple stump wearing a swim cap attached to a vacuum tube.
Lo and behold, that we were collecting sap in that way. We weren't just collecting moisture, we were collecting sap.
They realized, holy smokes, this could be something.
You know, from there, we're like, oh, this may be an entirely different way to do this.
If you can take a little sapling and get sap, why couldn't you just plant a whole field of little saplings tight together, like six times as many as in a standard forest?
It would be a way to expand maple production for, say, you know, a farmer that's like, oh, I've got a couple of acres. Am I going to plant grapevines, or am I going to plant maple trees and make maple syrup?
Every year, come sugaring time, some of those saplings could get cut, so they'd just be a stump, and a vacuum cap would go over the top of each one. It would look like a huge field of stumps attached to IVs. The trees would re-sprout from the stump, and a few years later, you could do it all again. No longer would you need a mature forest. You could have a maple plantation.
Maybe, you know, you don't have to invest in 200 acres of forest, mature forest land in Vermont to make a little maple syrup. Maybe you can, you know, instead of having a Christmas tree plantation, have an acre or two of maple and use that as, you know, have that as one of your crops and just kind of a new way to look at it.
One last gut check here. This is what industry does, drives relentlessly towards efficiency. Wall Street comes in, provides funding to turn a backwoods, backyard, part-time industry into an efficient, high-capital, highly productive business. So how would you feel if one day, instead of coming from a relatively diverse forest, your syrup came from what critics would call a soulless plantation? Are we going to watch as one of the last bastions of extensive agriculture is converted into yet another field crop?
I'm going to say, like, the idea of a field of, like, tightly planted 4-foot-tall saplings with, like, suction caps on the top of them is a little horrifying to me.
You're not the only one. So one of the biggest challenges is that is just from a marketing perspective, because we talked before about, you know, my favorite sugar bush and the feeling you get when you're in that sugar bush. You want to get that feeling standing in that field.
Okay, so maybe this is a step that the industry isn't ready to take yet. Abby announced her innovation with a big splash about 4 years ago, and as of yet, nobody has even tried it. It could be that this is just too far from the nostalgic picture that maple uses to market itself. But it also just might not be possible. Sugar maples are finicky trees. So we're probably not on the cusp of seeing matrix-like sugar maple pod farms. And as Abby points out,
just because big business is spending tens of millions on mystery maple factories and thousands of miles of tubing doesn't mean you have to.
You don't need much to make maple syrup. And, you know, I talk to people all the time that are like, yeah, this is my first year. I'm going to tap 5 trees in my yard. I'm, you know, making it evaporate out of hotel pans. And, you know, this works at any scale.
I guess it shouldn't really surprise us that the one product that seemed would be impossible to make efficiently isn't actually immune to the march of technology. But I like maple syrup a lot, and I'm not about to haul buckets and boil sap all spring, so I guess I'm glad that producers are finding ways to do that less. So, if you buy maple syrup at the store, just don't imagine that that sap has ever languished in a bucket on the side of a tree. And if you've got maples in your backyard and want to make some the old-fashioned way, just don't run the numbers on how long that syrup took to make. Outside In is produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Hannah McCarthy, Justine Paradise, Taylor Quimby, Nick Capodice, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is our director of internet dance-offs. Special thanks to Barbara Paulson, Mark Canella, Pascal Thériault, and Leslie Marks. Music from this week's episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, and Anthony Rajikov. Our theme music is from Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.